Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Robert Fiesler, whose new book is American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives. New Orleans writer Robert Fiesler is a journalist who investigates marginalized groups and a scholar who excavates forgotten history. A National Lesbian and Gay Journalist Association Journalist of the Year and the recipient of a Pulitzer Traveling Fellowship. His debut book, Tinderbox, The Untold Story of the Upstairs Lounge Fire and the Rise of Gay Liberation, received 7 awards, including the Edgar. His new book is American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives. Bobby Fiesler, welcome back to The Reading Life.
So happy to be here, Susan. Thank you.
Now, the opening of this book is so exciting. A hurricane is bearing down on the coast. Mm. Your husband is evacuated with 2 new kittens to North Mississippi.
Yes, to Columbus.
And you're racing to make it home from Florida to New Orleans with 20 boxes of papers.
Yes.
You shouldn't have.
Right.
You feel like you shouldn't have. And that sets the stage.
Yes.
For this great book that unfolds afterwards.
Oh, thank you. So, yes, that was the secret second set of the Florida Johns Committee records that the entire world had led me to believe didn't exist. And then about 2 years into researching American Scare, right when I was reaching a crisis point where I thought I was going to have to tell my publisher, I don't know if I can write this book. The state of Florida has redacted and perfectly censored all the records. I reached out to this one Tallahassee paralegal named Bonnie Stark, who had written in the mid-1980s the first master's thesis on this subject of the Florida Legislative Investigative Committee, which was basically a McCarthy-era inquisition committee that went after citizens of the state of Florida. And Bonnie Stark had written this master's thesis, and somehow she'd acquired the secret second set of records. As soon as I found out she had them, I was like, I gotta get them the heck out of the state of Florida before
right.
anyone figures out what they are and what I plan to do with them.
And how did she get them in the first place?
She never gets enough credit. She was the first scholar of this McCarthy-era subject involving the Florida Legislative Investigation Committee. She was present in Tallahassee during the late 1980s and early 1990s in what were the records release efforts, where a constitutional amendment got passed in the state of Florida that freaked Florida politicians out because suddenly they were going to have to release all of their sealed records, sealed documents. And Bonnie went and testified on behalf of the records for the Florida Johns Committee, and they listened to a lot of what she said. And so basically she earned a lot of allies and she gained a lot of sympathy for her ongoing research on this subject. And so basically when the records opened up, I think a lot of people had their eye on her. I think they admired her and respected her. And when it came time, they let her know that there was this other set that they wanted her personally to have. And this is the 90s. So I guess there wasn't
there wasn't
a gift of receipt or anything like that. She just pulled her car up to like the state Senate building, like the loading dock. They brought the boxes of these like records that no one thought existed out. And she brought them back to her various homes and she kept them for almost 30 years, telling no one. And then when I reached out to her to compliment her on her thesis, she told me, and I started crying when she told me, she said, I've got this second set of records and I want to give them to you.
That's such a marvelous, serendipitous.
I don't know what I did in another life to benefit from. Basically, this was just the ultimate journalistic and historic breakthrough that I knew was going to be able to facilitate all of the research I wanted to do in this book, where I wanted to make sure that I named the names of the victims, I highlighted what the state of Florida did to them way back when, and I wanted to be able to trace their stories as human beings, not as statistics. And I knew that Bonnie's research, collated with all sorts of other crazy stuff, would enable me to enact like a kind of Alan Turing-like de-censorship effort, where I was going to be able to crack the code and figure out what the state of Florida did way back when to Black citizens and queer citizens. And in 75% of the cases, I was able to do it.
20 boxes of papers, though.
My husband wanted to murder me. It's a private archive in the back of our house, basically. I'm donating the records, of course, because I can't keep them there and I can't live, but I lived amongst it. And I had to call lawyer friends, being like, how do you work through war rooms of records? And a lot of them said, piles, post-its. You're going to have to read all of it.
That's how I work through life, post-its. But it's like that thing, you know, Robert Caro thing. Read every page when you're researching. You have to look at everything.
Yeah, I greatly admire his work.
But how did you find out about the Johns Committee in the first place? This is, in so many ways, a hidden history.
So I found out initially, one of my mentor professors from the Columbia Journalism School, Sam Friedman, told me he'd gone to Miami, and he'd gone to the History Miami Museum and viewed this exhibit called Queer Miami. And he's like, you got to get down there. Mm-hmm. Bobby, I just know you got to get down there. And I was like, of course. I was broke at the time. My first book, Tinderbox, hadn't earned out yet. I was at a stage where I was like down to my last $10 a lot of times. So like, I couldn't figure out how to get to the Queer Miami exhibit. I finally found a way to scrape together $120, and I could book a flight to Miami from New Orleans, where I left. Literally, I had to get up at 3 a.m, take the earliest flight, get there, be at the museum when the museum opens, and then I'd have to stay in Miami for that day, and then I'd have to fly out the last flight that night. So no. I didn't have to pay for a hotel. But so I got there to Miami. I got to the museum. I walked into the Queer Miami exhibit, and my life changed. In one corner of the exhibit was two screens that were devoted to this subject I'd never heard of, this largely forgotten purge that for 9 years, from 1956 to 1965, held residents of the state of Florida ransom to this extrajudicial commission that had the power to declare Black school integrationists or closeted queer teachers enemies of the people. And it had been run by this guy, this segregationist, Dixiecrat, Southern Democrat, good old boy, charming senator named Charlie Johns. And what he perpetrated in this committee for 9 years became so notorious that they gave the committee the nickname the Johns Committee. They nicknamed it after him as the chairman. And so I walked into the Queer Miami exhibit. I'm looking at these two screens. On one of the screens is basically one of the greatest living experts on the subject, a historian who's now my friend named Stacy Brockman, who wrote a really important Johns Committee academic book called Communists and Perverts Under the Palms. And Stacy Brockman, as if cued, teasing me as I walk in the room, said, I don't think anyone really knows about the Johns Committee anymore.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just like, fish hook in mouth. I just was, I knew I was going to follow this story to the end of the earth. And Stacy, I eventually reached out to her and thanked her for saying on that video. I thanked the great Queer Florida scholar Julio Capo, who put together the Queer Miami exhibit. But it all happened because of this happenstance of people sort of leaving a breadcrumb trail for me. And then me feeling like I walked in at this moment where I just had to find out more about this story.
And what a gift from a great teacher, too.
Oh, my gosh.
Sam Friedman.
Yes. Sam Friedman knows my kind of story. He has this sort of spidey sense where he can point me towards things. And yes, that was one of the ultimate gifts of a great mentor. When he's seeing something that's probably amazing him, he's thinking of me in that moment, too. Yeah. I'm so appreciative of that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bobby Fiesler. His book is American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives. So tell us about these men who were the hunters, who they were and what motivated them.
Well, they were members of the Florida white elite. Many of them were Florida state legislators, which they were senators or members of the Florida House of Representatives. And these were individuals who had benefited. They were white. They were, in many cases, wealthy for the time period in a boom era of for the state of Florida. Post-World War II is the really exciting time where this rural agricultural backwater state surges into relevance suddenly and becomes like a hot place around the world, probably the scientific cultural envy, where Florida was hot, interesting. Everyone wanted to move down there. Miami was hopping, Tampa was hopping, all this stuff was going on. But within this new Florida, they were calling it, this state that was creeping up and really bursting into relevance post-World War II, was this old school political Tallahassee political culture. Mm-hmm. And they called these forms of old school Southern Tallahassee Democrats the pork choppers, or the pork chop gang. And this was a group of gerrymandered white legislators that basically ran by the old rules of, and the old political rules in Tallahassee were spoils and personal enrichment, personal revenge, making sure that there was no grudge left unturned, electoral manipulation, the ability as a representative to seek your own voters, seeking out constitutional loopholes. Once you held off, you would try to find a way to crown yourself king of that office as opposed to just holding it. And also doubling down and never admitting when you're wrong. That was the political culture of the pork choppers. And so all of the pork choppers, including Charlie Johns, who ran the Johns Committee, basically had taken a literal blood oath that they were going to hold this new state of Florida, which was experiencing an influx of population from around the world and from many northern states, to old Southern, really post-Reconstruction rules, some of the most racist, some of the most shockingly disparate rules that any American society has ever run by. The number of lynchings that occurred in the state of Florida are just ghastly. The state of what would happen if you were a black person who had the bravery, or what Southern white segregationists would call the temerity, to ask for equal rights is astounding. And so basically, the people that were the hunters of the Johns Committee followed those political rules. And the reason that they wanted this McCarthy-era committee was that they wanted any excuse to hold on to power. Mm-hmm. Post-Brown v. Board of Education, post-1954, the Supreme Court decision that was going to integrate, so that they could keep their segregated Florida going with them in charge just 1 year, 1 month, 1 day longer. And they were willing to bring down the entire country if necessary to do so.
And they were relentless for years, almost a decade, right?
Correct. Yeah.
I mean, and they focused in their quest to identify civil rights leaders, they focused on organizations pretty much.
They did. They really went after the Florida NAACP was their target, because that was the major institution that was asking for school integration, bus integration, pool integration, beach integration, water fountains, the ability for a black person to walk on the street and not have to step aside when a white person passed, all of that. So the Johns Committee thought if they targeted the leaders of the Florida NAACP, if they could get them on the stand in a McCarthy-like or House Un-American Activities like setup, they could get them under oath, and if they could get them for any reason to state an inconsistency, even in good faith, after making them testify for several hours, they could charge them with perjury, and then they could jail them. And they thought by jailing the leaders under these insincere pretenses, that basically they could stop the integration effort in the rapidly modernizing state of Florida. And one of the leaders they went after most harshly was the architect of school desegregation in Miami, a Protestant minister named Father Theodore Gibson, who was a African-American gentleman in Coral Gables, incredibly well-respected citywide, who was suing on behalf of his younger son to try to allow his younger son the opportunity to attend a well-funded, academically rigorous high school. He sued for many years. Father Gibson was the named plaintiff on this lawsuit to desegregate schools and to offer his son an equal education. And the Johns Committee spotted in him a really good target. And they hounded him all the way to the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court.
But he emerges as such a hero in this book. You like him so much when you're reading him.
Yes. I think about his story, and I feel really patriotic and proud that
right.
This is an American citizen an American hero who exemplifies so many of our nation's finest ideals, and the way that in an era when it was not favorable to him, that he stands up against the forces of injustice, against the white segregationists. It's tremendous, and it's, I think, a story that more people need to know. When you read this type of American story, I feel like it makes a heart swell.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bobby Fiesler. His book is American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives. As they focused on LGBTQ leaders and people, they turned toward university settings. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this book is set in the university. So tell us about that and that kind of focus and approach.
Sure. Well, the Johns Committee had a budget that they needed to expend with a certain number of time as part of their appropriation. And their first enemy, the Florida NAACP, unfortunately for them, had some of the finest lawyers of the 20th century that were fighting for them as part of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Thurgood Marshall, Robert Carter, yeah, et cetera. And so the NAACP gummed up the Johns Committee in the court system with various lawsuits that were slowly winding their way and not on the timeline of Charlie Johns and the committee that needed to expend a certain amount of money and also to produce proverbial heads on spikes and show public enemies to their supporters within the very conservative Florida political system. And so they figured out that, well, maybe there are going to be some communist educators in places like University of Florida, Gainesville. They remembered during the HUAC testimonies in Washington, D.C. in the early 50s, a few University of Florida professors had testified controversially. Let's go get them now. And so they turned up at Gainesville. And unfortunately, they quickly realized they were completely unqualified or incapable. They didn't have the competencies to find a single communist, much less a Soviet spy or anything like that. This was not they didn't have a real Red Scare set of expertise as detectives. So what they did was they started following individuals, and they noticed a lot of these professors are members of this local theater troupe. Oh, and they seem to hug each other a lot. Oh, and they go to this bachelor bar. Oh, and sometimes they go, I don't know why, but they go down to this really mysterious looking bathroom in the basement of the local courthouse together. I think these men might be homosexuals. And so the Johns Committee then realized they had a politically opportune moment where they could utilize the rest of their budget to target this very isolated, very underground, very, in many cases, not even identified homosexual community that was part of an already among conservatives unpopular group, professors and educators, that they could go get them. They could get these people, they could pull them out of classrooms, they could pull them out of their homes, they could interrogate them in random settings, and they could maybe even get them to admit to even a sliver of behavior that was then considered not just immoral but illegal, that they could then publicly fire them, and they could get great news headlines. And the Johns Committee loved great news headlines for itself.
Well, tell us about Art Copleston, because he's one of the ones you dedicate the book to.
Yeah, Art Copleston is among the last living survivors of the anti-gay Johns Committee Inquisition at University of Florida, Gainesville. And he was an undergraduate student. He was about in his late 20s, who had earlier in life served in the Air Force at Tyndall Air Force Base near close to Panama City. And then he was attending the University of Florida on the GI Bill. He'd had a very hard upbringing where he was the only child of alcoholic parents who he basically had to raise. He also was financially supporting them, even during his U.S. Air Force service. And the GI Bill for him represented his one chance to ever go to college and get it paid for. He also was clandestinely, in some cases in a very non-identified way, where he didn't let his right hand know what his left was doing, etc., was a gay man. He, he, from a young age, had only been attracted to other men. So he got to the University of Florida. He's this sort of elvishly handsome young guy who for 1 year, absolutely thrived on the University of Florida campus. merged perfectly with classmates and a cohort that in some cases were almost 7 years younger than him, maybe 8 years at various points. He had some boyfriends, et cetera, and he found some professors that were also closeted gay that began to mentor him. And he was personally targeted in his sophomore year by the state of Florida. He was tracked. He was harassed. He was mentally scrambled and tortured by specifically two campus officers, one named Officer Tileston.
Who comes across as such a villain, such a creepy, creepy villain in this piece.
Who was around his age. That was the weird part. Tileston was a war veteran, but he'd spent time in the military service too, but he was just a guy that was looking for advancement from he was basically a glorified campus security guard that was like, you know, went from punishing kids who were throwing gum wrappers on the sidewalk to suddenly he got swept up into this state inquisition. He was sort of dubbed their man on campus, and he became their personal spy, and he made it his mission to personally follow and track this suspected gay student, Art Copleston, for almost the entirety of the rest of Art Copleston's undergraduate life on campus. And it mentally scrambled the level of anxiety and stress of that. Art Copleston knew that if he was ever identified positively as being gay, he would lose his GI Bill funding, he would get kicked off of the campus, and he would have no chance at the kind of life he wanted to live. His parents, who were alcoholics and who he basically had to take care of, were going to offer no support, and they might actually swear him off and disown him if it ever became known what his sexual habits were. So he lived for 3 years in complete and utter terror on the University of Florida campus, and the day he graduated was basically the last day he lived in the state of Florida. He packed up his stuff into a car, and he left and never came back.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bobby Fiesler. His book is American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives. So where will these papers go?
I'm going to be donating them. There's an organization called Invisible Histories, which, similar to the Archives Project, is a nonprofit that has a mission to preserve and to locate queer Southern histories and to make sure that the records are available for the people that want to do the important historical work and journalistic work. I did a lot of research thinking about where the Johns Committee papers need to go. I decided they can't ever go back to the state of Florida. Even in a private context, I don't trust them there. I needed to give them to an organization that I think was going to not just take care of them, but defend them, and also is committed to digitizing them. Because I think out of 20 boxes, I wrote one book. I think there's at least 5 or 6 other Johns Committee books. I mean, this committee did so many terrible things. It's just astounding the scope of devastation they wrought for 9 years. And so I want the next generations of Johns Committee scholars to be able to access these papers, specifically the Bonnie Stark papers, in a way that was a lot easier and a lot more turnkey than my journey, which, as you noted, had a lot to do with serendipity.
And perseverance, of course.
But that's the miracle of reporting. Like, you hammer at things, you bash your head against the door you never think is going to open, and then eventually one day it does. That's the
then
story.
Then you try the knob.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Yes.
There you go.
Yes.
Well, congratulations. This is an amazing piece of work.
Oh, thank you. No, it was an honor to write.
Well, I can see that you felt the responsibility to all those people deeply and sincerely as you read it.
I want people to know what happened to them, and I want people to understand why they were remarkable Americans.
Amazing. We've been talking with Bobby Fiesler, Robert Fiesler, whose new book is American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives. You can meet him Tuesday, June 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Bobby, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Stephen Michael Shearer discusses and signs Gloria Swanson, Hollywood's first glamour queen, Friday, June 13th at 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Dr. Sarah Reardon appears in conversation with New Orleans moms Angelina Vicknair and signs her book Floored, A Woman's Guide to Pelvic Floor Health at Every Age and Stage, Friday, June 13th at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. Jay Gaudet presents a Juneteenth financial therapy session on Sunday, June 15th at 4 at Garden District Bookshop and signs copies of You're Not Broke, You're Broken, How to Move Past Your Financial Failures. Pam Abel, a longtime reader and writer of fiction, presents Long Story Short, Why and How to Write and Market Short Stories, 1 to 3:30 p.m. on three separate Mondays starting June 16th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. John Durrell discusses and signs his book Descendants, Monday, June 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Robert Fiesler discusses and signs American Scare, Florida's Hidden Cold War on Black and Queer Lives, Tuesday, June 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Blue Cypress Books host author Erica Stern in conversation with Marguerite Scheffer about her debut novel Frontier, a memoir and ghost story, Wednesday, June 18th at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will sponsor a warehouse sale Saturday, June 21st from 9 to 1 or until they run out of books. That's at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Books will be sold by the box, including CDs, children's books, cookbooks, romance, regular fiction, and DVDs. Boxes will be labeled as to a category but cannot be opened prior to purchasing. Payment may be made using cash or a credit card, and for more info, contact the Friends at 504-455-2665 or email friendsjpl@yahoo.com. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.